Welcome to Bible Study for Progressives, a show where moderates, liberals, and leftists of all faiths and ideologies come together to discuss scripture, spirituality, and politics. Today's show is God Called a Writer, Paul's Mystical Conversion Experience. We will read Galatians chapter 1, verses 11 to 12, and we will examine mystical experiences and our occupational calling. How can we use our own unique gifts and abilities for the common good so as to glorify God? I have with me today Professor David Westfall. My name is Rich Procida, and I write biblical commentary at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Let's begin. For I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that the gospel that was proclaimed by me is not of human origin. For I did not receive it from a human source, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. You have heard, no doubt, of my earlier life in Judaism. I was violently persecuting the Church of God and was trying to destroy it. I advanced in Judaism beyond many among my people of the same age, for I was far more zealous for the traditions of my ancestors. But when God, who had set me apart before I was born and called me through His grace, was pleased to reveal His Son to me, so that I might proclaim Him among the Gentiles, I did not confer with any human being, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were already apostles before me, but I went away at once to Arabia, and afterwards I returned to Damascus. Then, after 3 years, I did go up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and stayed with him 15 days. But I did not see any other apostle except James, the Lord's brother. In what I'm writing to you before God, I do not lie. Then I went into the regions of Syria and Cilicia, and I was still unknown by sight to the churches of Judea that are in Christ. They only heard it said, "The one who was formerly persecuting us is now proclaiming the faith he once tried to destroy." And they glorified God because of me. God Called a Writer, Paul's Mystical Conversion Experience, by Rich Procida. In memory of Marcus J. Borg. Paul was unimpressive in person. People said, "His letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech contemptible." Paul described himself as humble when face to face and bold when away. He wrote so powerfully, he worried his letters scared people. His letters were strong, but in person, he was just like you and me. Paul's conversion in Damascus as told by Luke some 50 years later, is an important Christian story. Luke describes it three times in the book of Acts. In each, Luke describes Paul's conversion as sudden. Paul is breathing threats of murder against the disciples all the way up to his vision on the road to Damascus. In fact, Luke says Paul is out hunting Christians down when, suddenly, he sees a flash of light all around him and hears a voice say, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" The vision lasts long enough for Paul to ask, "Who are you, Lord?" "I am Jesus," the voice replied, "whom you are persecuting." Paul was a mystic. He had visions. He saw and spoke to the risen Christ. He claimed his writings and teachings were revelations from God. When Paul says he conferred with no one and instead went away to Arabia, he's saying his teachings come directly from God. They are not of human origin. Mystics have experiences of union or direct communication with spirit or ultimate reality. Mystical experiences are often described as ineffable, something too great to be put into words. They happen unexpectedly and are noetic. They impart a strong sense of knowing, not simply an ecstatic feeling. Marcus J. Borg and John Dominic Crossan define mysticism as union with God. They describe mystical experiences as vivid and ecstatic experiences of God, the sacred, or ultimate reality. William James, America's leading philosopher of the late 19th century, in his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, defined the mystical experience broadly as a vivid sense of union and illumination. The father of American psychology, William James identified four characteristics of mystical experiences. First, mystical experiences are ineffable. The experience is beyond words. It cannot be fully described. Paul describes his experiences as being caught up in a third heaven, a paradise where he heard things that are not to be told, that no mortal is permitted to repeat. Second, mystical experiences are noetic. They impart profound knowledge. This includes a sense of enlightenment, what James calls illumination. One might have a vivid sense of seeing more clearly than one has ever seen before, or of seeing the world the way it really is. This is similar and different from claircognizance or clairknowing, one of the four types of psychic abilities. The other types are clairvoyance, clairaudience, and clairsentience. These correspond to psychic vision, hearing, and feeling or sensing, all of which impart knowledge and information. Third, mystical experiences are transient. They are outside our normal perception of space and time. When they are over, the mystic simply returns to his normal state. In my experience, mystical experiences don't last as long as one would like. Psychics experience a similar type of transcendence, where they obtain information spontaneously. Spirit speaks to them. Some psychics are able to do this at will. For others, including myself, they just happen. Finally, mystical experiences are unpredictable. They happen unexpectedly. The mystic does not control them. According to James, mystics cannot turn mystical experiences on and off. This is different from many psychics or mediums who are able to open and close themselves to spiritual communication. There are also different types of mystical experiences. Paul experiences what James calls a photism, a vision of light or a being of light. Photisms can also involve seeing the world as radiant or full of light. The light can also sometimes be yellow or golden. 20th century scholar of comparative religion, Mircea Eliade, called these experiences of the golden world. For Paul, the light was so brilliant, it blinded him for 3 days. According to Acts, Paul remained blind until a Christian Jew named Ananias laid hands on him. Immediately, the Holy Spirit enters Paul, restoring his vision. Vision here includes new understanding. Paul says he did not confer with anyone. Instead, he went into Arabia, which refers to the desert around Damascus and not the Arabian desert. Paul continued to learn and have visions. Paul also hears a voice, what James calls an audition. Auditions are not always part of the mystical experience. Clairaudience is similar, except that a psychic hears the voice internally and not as Paul experienced the voice coming from a being of light. Marcus J. Borg, an author along with John Dominic Crossan, upon whom I rely, wrote about his mystical experiences on his blog. Quote, "My experiences were what scholars of mysticism call extroverted or eyes open mystical experiences. The other type is introverted or eyes closed. I saw the same visual landscape, a forest, a room, the inside of an airliner, that I normally see. There were no extra beings, no angels. For a minute or two, and once for the better part of an hour, what I was seeing looked very different. Light became different, as if there were a radiance shining through everything. The biblical phrase for this is the glory of God. As the book of Isaiah puts it, the earth is filled with the glory, the radiance of God. The world was transfigured, even as it remained the same. And I experienced a falling away of the subject-object distinction that marks our ordinary, everyday experience. That sense of being a separate self in here, while the world is out there. They were experiences of wonder, not of curiosity, but of what the 20th century Jewish theologian Abraham Herschel called radical amazement. They were also experiences in which I felt that I was seeing more clearly than I ever had before. that what I was experiencing was the way things are. And they were also experiences of complete peacefulness, marked by a sense that I would love to stay in this mental state forever. Anxiety and distraction utterly disappeared. Everything looked beautiful. Unquote. I personally classify psychics, mediums, prophets, and spiritual healers among mystics because they work with spirit too. Psychics and mediums communicate with spirit to obtain otherwise unknowable information. The Sufi whirling dervishes of Turkey are able to induce religious ecstasy. Certain spiritual practices, such as meditation, open one up to mystical experiences. For example, guided meditation can induce vision-like mystical experiences. For many people, mystical experiences happen rarely and without warning, perhaps once in a person's life. People have experienced visions throughout history. Paul himself lists those who have also seen the risen Christ. Mystical experiences, however, are not limited to Christians. The Buddha had visions and obtained enlightenment while meditating under the Bodhi tree. All religions have mystics. I've had mystical and paranormal experiences throughout my life. I've even had a mystical conversion experience. It occurred in what some might say an unlikely place, an introductory feminist studies class at the University of Southern California. In reality, it is no less likely a place than a dirt road in Damascus. My mystical experience didn't involve an audition. I heard no voice. The context, a class on feminism, was loud and clear. Why am I persecuting women? Jesus taught that whatever you do to the least of God's children, you do to God. I took the class for general education and to help me solve my deep-seated problems related to my childhood. I was searching for answers, for knowledge, self-discovery, spiritual enlightenment, emotional healing, and stern direction. I hoped to learn something to help me deal with my issues and improve my social relationships, especially with women. In other words, things I needed to know. Instead, I caused trouble. It wasn't my fault. I simply participated actively. I asked searching questions and pressed the professors on issues. I had issues. It felt like I didn't understand, even though I earned high grades on all the exams. The course had two midterm exams and one final. It also had a similar discussion group led by an older graduate student with frizzy hair. She told us about her cats and looked increasingly frazzled as the course went on. I was having difficulty with the other students in this portion of the class. I thank her for her patience and support. The lectures were held in a lecture hall. One entered at the side of the rectangular room. The seats faced left and sloped up away from the stage. About 100 students would fill the hall. I had 3 visions in that room, one after each exam. After finishing the first midterm early, I turned in my papers at the stage and walked politely and quietly up the sloping walkway toward the door. Suddenly, I saw a bright ball of white light, larger than a basketball, and hovering in front of me. It came in a flash. I jerked my head back and felt blood rush to my face. I exclaimed, "Whoa!" I immediately recognized it as a mystical experience. Shocked, I gathered myself and left the room. What was that? I thought. How interesting to have a vision in class, especially a feminist class. It confirmed I was right to take the course. When the second midterm exam came around, I thought little of my experience. Even though I've had paranormal experiences before, they were extremely rare. It was unlikely to happen again. I was grateful simply for the experience I had. I focused on the exam and did well. Confident and satisfied with my performance, I turned in my exam and walked up towards the door. As I approached the door this time, a large oval of bright white light appeared in front of me. The flash nearly filled the entire room. This time, the light knocked me backwards. I exclaimed loudly, "Whoa!" I must have said a few more things as I looked to see if anyone else had seen what I had. I quickly realized by the looks people gave me that no one else had seen the light, but I had been loud and disturbing enough to anger the professors. Later, the professors would call me into their office. I had disturbed the class during the examination, the professors told me. I explained what happened, but the professors were skeptical. The female professor confronted me. "You disrupted the exam," she said in a low, angry voice. There were three professors in the class, a female professor, a gay male professor, and a pro-feminist male professor. I told them I now planned to minor in the study of women and men in society, now that I've had these experiences. They were surprised. I'm sure they assumed that I had been making fun of the class. They seemed confused and not sure about what to do. They seated me outside the office for what seemed like a long time. When they came out, they gave me a warning. I would be in serious trouble if I interrupted the final exam. When the final exam came, I prepared. I decided to hold my mouth tightly closed as I walked out. If I had another vision, I would not let a sound escape my mouth. I finished the exam early and handed in my paper. The female professor snatched it with an angry stare, baring her teeth on the right side of her mouth. I walked slowly along the stage and turned left to walk up toward the door. As I approached the door, I thought it unlikely to happen again. The closer I got to the door, the more I thought nothing would happen. As I came close to the door, I said to myself, "It's not going to happen." Then suddenly, a huge bright light flashed all around me. The air from my lungs filled my mouth. My vocal cords vibrated with the sound of my voice, rattled the roof of my mouth. I struggled to keep my mouth closed. Exhaling into my closed mouth, the sound of my voice muffled, my eyes rolled up. I felt my head lifted up, pulling me up and back as a warm light flowed over and through my body. I must have fell backwards to the floor, unconscious, because the next thing I remember is smelling a wretched acid-like smell and waking up to medics kneeling over me, holding something up to my nose. So that's what smelling salt smelled like. Another new discovery, I thought. I wasn't sure what the first discovery was. I felt the sense of knowing something, but I didn't know what. The medic said I may have had a seizure. I told them no. I just had a mystical experience, a vision of a bright light. They looked at me strangely. Now I've become a psych case to them, I thought. They asked me to lay down on the stretcher. I did so in my passive, accommodating way, but quickly realized it looked bad. I didn't need medical treatment, and I certainly didn't need a stretcher. So I got up, refused medical care, and went home. Paul gained from his mystical experiences his vocational call. Paul became determined to become an apostle to the Gentiles. He called the law a ministry of death, chiseled in letters on stone tablets. He said those who practice circumcision were dogs and evil workers who mutilate the flesh. He made Christianity palatable to Gentiles. Though he considered himself a Jew his entire life, in many ways he founded Christianity. My journey has brought me back to Christianity. But in the beginning, God drove me out of the church. We were in the middle of the culture wars, and the church I knew was on the wrong side. When Paul says he conferred with no one and went into the desert, this may represent a period of contemplation, a time to figure out what had just happened. After my experience, I had to contemplate its meaning. I felt I had to at least minor in gender studies, but I couldn't major in it. That would be too over the top. I majored in international relations and human communication instead, and would go on to study international service and law at American University in Washington, D.C. Soon after my experience, I learned that some students were forming the Students' Alliance for a Non-Sexist Society. They graciously welcomed me and became my friends. I decided to focus on the issue of pornography. It seemed something proper for a feminist man to work on, because men are the main consumers, and violence against women is a male issue. For the next few years, I gave lectures on pornography from a feminist perspective at colleges around Southern California. I founded People Against Pornography, published articles, and made a few radio and minor television appearances. By the time I got to law school, I had burnt out on the issue of pornography. After all my lectures and interactions with others, my views changed. Using the law to punish people for what is largely consensual activity isn't the solution. In my last year of law school, I decided to combine my extensive knowledge of the subject with my newly found knowledge of constitutional law to publish a book. I co-authored a survey of domestic and foreign laws and social attitudes towards sexually explicit materials, titled Global Issues in Social Perspective, Pornography. It has been peer-reviewed and is still in print. I am now writing biblical commentary and engaging in progressive Christian social activism. Like Paul, I have much to do. My vision gave me a vocation to advance progressive Christianity. I continue in my other vocation, helping the poor and disabled in my job as a Social Security disability attorney. Paul claims his visions of Christ make him an apostle equal to the 12 who accompanied Jesus during his lifetime. Paul believed Jesus called him to apostleship out of the womb. When Paul cites the prophets, he thinks they're predicting him, not Jesus. He implores his followers to listen to no teaching other than his own. Paul's experience of the divine Jesus, an entity he calls Christ, caused him to claim supernatural authority. Though I feel inspired when I write, I don't claim authority like that. I take the spiritual gifts literally and believe we all have gifts and abilities. All of us can be inspired. Some churches call their ministers apostles and prophets. I'm partial to that, but I don't call myself an apostle. My visions make me a mystic, even a prophet, broadly defined. But it doesn't make me better than other people. Paul doesn't claim that superiority either. Well, my visions have made me a better, happier, and well-adjusted person, just as with Paul. God has chosen a flawed and misguided person to redeem Christianity and to spread the good news, something we are all called to do. Paul persecuted Christians. He voted to put them to death. He stood by while they were executed. Paul, by supporting the execution of Jewish Christians, was little more than a murderer. Like me, Paul was young, lost, and wrong. But God redeemed us anyway and set us on a mission in which we use our gifts in the service of God. For me, as for Paul, one of my gifts is the ability to write. Paul did not know the historical Jesus. Paul knew the risen Christ. None of his contemporaries describe Jesus as Paul does. To Paul, Christ is a new being, a life-sustaining, giving spirit. Paul transformed the man, Jesus of Nazareth, into Jesus Christ, a divine, pre-existent being, whose death and resurrection began a new genesis of eternal beings. Even Matthew and Luke, written around 90 CE, use Son of God exactly as used throughout the Bible, as a royal title. It's not until the Gospel of John, written around 100 CE, that we find the vision of the eternal Logos, the only begotten Son. Paul's letters are the earliest documents in the New Testament. Paul didn't know Jesus when he was alive, but he was his contemporary. Over time, the church would come to follow Paul's view. It wasn't until the 5th century that all of Christendom agreed on a canon that included one letter from James, two letters from Peter, four letters from John, and 14 letters attributed to Paul. Many of the letters attributed to Paul were actually written later by Paul's followers, but half of the book of Acts is also about Paul. Paul wrote at least 7 of the letters attributed to him, and possibly 3 more. Paul lived into his 70s. He continued writing. He penned his last letter to the Romans just before going to Jerusalem, where he would be arrested, taken to Rome, and executed. While Paul is a saint, his legacy is his writings. Without Paul, Rome might have destroyed Jewish Christianity along with the temple in 70 CE. Christianity, as we know it, would not exist. Okay. Now let's turn to our discussion with Professor Westfall. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Rich, for inviting me.
You're welcome. So what should we make of Paul's claims here? Is he telling the truth, or is this just an ancient way of claiming religious authority? Do you believe what Paul's saying here?
I believe that Paul's telling his accurate testimony of what happened to him. Okay. Some of this has happened in times past and so forth, and, you know, say your memories may fade a little bit and things change a little bit when you retell these things, but I think Paul is really telling us pretty much what happened to him as best as he could recall.
And, lost that there. So, how about other people? There are people who have claimed to have had mystical experience. Throughout history, throughout the church's history, and even into the present, do people really have these experiences?
I really can't speak about other people. I can really just tell, only about my own personal experiences, and I haven't really had any experiences like that, but I'm not like these other people, and they're not me, so I'm not really in a position to judge somebody's experiences. I think in general, unless you see some reason to think somebody is lying to you, and there are certain people in the world who do that, you more or less take what they say for granted. There's been a long history of writing. There have been a number of people, Christian mystics, who have written about their experiences and so forth. And a lot of this stuff has become devotional reading. It's become very popular throughout Christianity over the years. And I haven't read much along those lines. One of these days I'll get a couple of those books and kind of read them through. But these people are generally held to be in well thought of in Christian circles. If they don't get wander too far from what most people see as Christianity.
I'm wondering, with these types of things, what's at stake? Why is Paul telling us this? Is there an ulterior motive,
I think Paul is really just trying to establish where he's coming from, okay? Why he's saying what he's saying, and where he got it, and why it's important to people. And Paul's writings have been generally accepted in Christianity as being pretty much a good summation of the theology in terms of, the theology of Christianity, and also in terms of, practical applications of it. One of the things that a former pastor used to say, that Paul's epistles, he started out in the heavenlies, okay? He was really talking about pretty abstract and spiritual type things, and toward the end of most of the epistles, he got down into very practical applications, just how you live your life among others. My wife used to be a kindergarten teacher, and one of the verses she had for those children was the one about be kind to one another, okay? Because little kids tend to get in arguments and squabbles and things like that, and she just wanted to emphasize to them this very practical thing. They needed to be kind to each other.
I sort of believe Paul, because I think about how he changed, and there's nothing to me that really explains that adequately, except that he had these experiences. Now, I think people sometimes make more out of these experiences than what they really are. When you have people telling you you have to believe them and you have to follow them, and that they had this Korean minister come from, and he was at the Crystal Cathedral, and that's exactly what he was saying. I have this revelation, you know, you have to follow me, you have to believe in me. And I don't think that that's making too much of what these things are. We tend to think of them as something coming from God, as if this is such a profound, it is a profound experience individually, but it's not something that is any different from what other people do. In fact, some of the other gifts and abilities may be more important, because, I mean, we're here in the material world. If we were meant to all have these otherworldly experiences, then we'd probably be living in a different world. We wouldn't have such a strong illusion of material reality. And it's that work in material reality, in the world as it actually is, that is more important than somebody having a transient experience. That transient experience, though, may be very important to that person individually, and it may guide them in what their future is and what they want to do. It certainly says nothing about them being a better person, because obviously Paul was not a good person necessarily when he had the experience. In fact, it was more of a God intervening to change this person. So if we put these, even though we put Paul on a pedestal a little bit, he put himself, he said, I'm an apostle too. But of course there were other living apostles at that time. So it's not really out of the that much out of the ordinary. And then even there are churches today that still call their participants prophets and apostles. But even Paul says, God speaks through us just normally. God can speak through us and gives us words to say. And so how that's just as important as any mystical experience. So I get this sense that people, when they have this idea, well, should I believe him? It doesn't really matter so much. I mean, I can't hold my personal experiences back and hold them inside. This is what I remember happened to me. This is what happened. It changed me. It had a lot of influence on me. It ended up writing a book out of it. And now I'm doing this work, and it's helped me with my spirituality and spiritual development. And I like to think that what I say is important and has some meaning, and maybe the future people will read it just like the other mystics that they read, or maybe I'll write something that will have some staying power. I mean, my book has been in print for over 10 years. It might be, it's going on 15 years that book's been in print, and it's an academic survey. I mean, at least it's still listed on the website. It's still being sold. So that's a pretty good achievement. Maybe that book will have some lasting effect, and maybe some of my writings will stay around. And that's really what I'm hoping for. And I might be able to lead people to change, because we have a real problem with religious extremism in the country. And we're going to have to address that. And somehow I think that the theology or doctrines of the church have sort of made people into conservatives, or made them. In other words, as a lawyer, I recognize that the first thing that you do is you get somebody to believe, agree with you on one thing, and then you can get them to agree with everything else you can say. If you can get them to agree on the first proposition, and it's usually the first proposition that is the most tricky, because, and it's a great, so as a lawyer, I recognize that technique, and I see it in Christianity when they say, believe that Jesus was risen by the dead, or Jesus is God, that he came. Believe this one thing. And if you believe that one thing, they've got you hooked. You're in there. And then they start feeding you the conservative theology. So it's important for people to recognize that that's why we lose elections. That religion is a reason why we lose elections. And to start to take religion seriously, not just as a spiritual, but as a political form, that everything about religion is political, but it's also personal, because one of the tenets of feminism is that the personal is political. In other words, the individual woman's life in her home under the oppression of her husband seems like a personal experience, but it's really a very political experience, because it's the experience of a lot of women. That was something that Betty Friedan brought out in the feminine mystique. But if we get back to, so I'm wondering what you think about this. This dramatic and incontroversial vertebral change in Paul make Paul's claims more credible?
I think I'll talk about my own conversion experience. Okay.
That would be great.
Okay. Started out, I was raised in the Catholic Church, and then after that, we went off into the Episcopal Church over the birth control issue. That was basically my parents did. That was when I was younger. And from there, I went off into atheism, and that and heavy drinking. And I was kind of stuck in that rut for about 10 years. After that, some people came by. I always had the idea that, I could shape up, if and when I decided it was time to. And my wife had our first child, our baby daughter, and at that point, it was kind of like, maybe this is going to be a good time to start shaping up, found out it wasn't really all that easy. As a matter of fact, I wasn't being very successful in shaping up. And then some people came by from a church, and they handed me a tract. And the woman there, she was kind of cute.
That's usually how it works.
And so anyway, I went to that church, and I heard the pastor preaching, and he'd never seen me before in his life. And it seemed like he had me pretty well figured out. And so this was just really one of these old-fashioned churches there. And they had an altar call, and I didn't go forward the first week, but I went forward the second week and put my faith and trust in Jesus. And my life was changed. Okay, I mean, that's, to me, one of the biggest things here about Christianity is it changed my life. And I've met other people too who've had very dramatic conversion experiences. There was a guy in that church, and he'd been a drug addict, and they got him into Teen Challenge, and he got free of the drug addiction. From there on, he was really, he was a great guy, he was, after that, he was doing the right things instead of the wrong things, okay? And so people's experiences, all kinds of different experiences. Now, I haven't had anything like a mystical experience, but I certainly had an experience here that changed my life. I came back from that church, I talked to my wife, and I was just so happy, and I mean, things were different. I had a big problem with alcohol before that. Well, I didn't have a problem with alcohol after that. I still had plenty of other problems, but I didn't have to deal with that. And that was one that was, alcohol is the type of problem that creates a lot of other problems, okay? So I got no problem with experiences. I got the experience that I need. Maybe somebody else needed a mystical experience, and that was the thing that was for them. That's fine. Let God, let the Holy Spirit decide who gets what experience. He knows better how to sort this stuff out than we do anyhow.
One of the things I realized recently is that my parents had that type of experience where they changed. But a lot of people have also who have been brought up in the church. I was brought up in the church, as opposed to, I guess you were brought up in the church as well. And then we may have those experiences, but not in the same context, not in the same context of an altar call. For me, I've had a number of experiences, but this one was in school, in a feminist class, which is, as I've said before, exactly where it probably should have been. So that God could speak to us, and we can have these different experiences in different context.
Right.
and still have those changes. Of course, I've had to work on changing. It's not like it just is all done for me when that happens, but
it wasn't all done for me either. I'm still working on this. Yes. 50 years later.
Yeah,
40 years later.
Me too.
50 years, yeah. Let's see, 1971. Okay, 29, 44 years later.
Yeah. Now, do you have anything that you would like consider an occupational calling? You know, like Paul had the occupation of calling of being an apostle to the Gentiles. You know, I might have one of writing a book on feminism or dealing with violence against women or dealing with promoting progressive Christianity or different or new theology. Did you feel you ever had like an occupational calling for Christ or something to that extent?
I kind of do. I do a certain amount of writing and I do a certain amount of just dialoguing with people. And one of the nice things about the internet is you could be talking to people all over the world in different places and they don't know you and you don't know them, but you can certainly communicate with them. And so I guess you could say maybe I've got an occupational calling. One is to reaching out to people who are not Christians. Another one would be also reaching out to people that are involved in Christianity but kind of stuck in fundamentalism. And I think fundamentalism, it's kind of a blind alley, okay? You basically, and most fundamentalism are just, they want to throw out history and they want to throw out science, okay? And I see that the world here is another part of the revelation for God, the creation. And so we're studying the creation and we can learn things from it. Okay. And I think this becomes a lot of problems here for young people, especially as they have been taught, you know, that the earth is 6,000 years old. And when they faced with a great deal of evidence that it is much older than that, they think, well, the fundamentalists say, you know, if we can't believe this, we can't believe anything. Now, it doesn't really work that way, you know. If I have to believe that, I can't believe some of the other stuff, okay? I think the fundamental thing is Jesus and what he did and how he rose from the dead, okay? This was something that kind of, you know, the apostles and the gospels and Paul and everything like that, it was kind of, people kind of, it took them a while for all that to sink in and build up and be understood, okay? And I see, you know, that the revelation is not being some kind of dictation, but it's some kind of a progressive process where human beings, seeking God and learning of him and so forth, kind of gradually figure it out.
Now, what about, you may have an opinion, what about these psychics and mediums and people who practice other forms of spirituality? Are they for real? I mean, do you have any, and I use this word prejudices or against those who practice New Age or pagan religions?
Well, the Apostle Paul, who we've been talking about, says in the end of Ephesians he says, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, and against the powers of this dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly realms. So basically, it looks like we're making kind of a distinction here. We've got spirituality, and some of it comes from God, and some of it doesn't, okay? So I think that's an important distinction to kind of hang on to, that there are things happening on a supernatural basis that we probably shouldn't be involved with. So that's my personal take on it. I'd like to stay on the right side of that division.
I think that a lot of that, what you read there, has to do with the rulers. And this is really Paul talking about the empire. And that's how I interpret that, that the spiritual powers and the powers and principalities, these are the forces of evil at work in the world. So when we're talking about evil, we're talking not about things that go bump in the night, which is usually what people tend to think of when they think of psychics or ghosts. We're talking about the Holocaust. We're talking about slaughter, torture. These are the poverty, injustice. These are the results of what Paul is really trying to get at there. Was that Philippians that you read? Or
that was the end, last chapter in Ephesians.
Ephesians.
Okay. It's the famous chapter about the armor of God.
Yeah.
Okay. That's his introduction. He says basically that because of this, that's why we need to put on these pieces of armor. But, I think you got a good point there. Power, that's not a biblical statement, but the guy that said, Edmund Burke, I think, he says power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Okay, when people get power, they do things that are not right. And one of the biggest problems of Christianity goes back to the time of Constantine, the emperor, when Constantine decided, well, let's just have all the empire be all Christians. Okay, and at that point, Christianity got in bed with the powers of the world here, and that condition has been going on. It's kind of broke up a little bit in the Reformation, but it actually didn't break up that much, because then the separate Protestant denominations ended up getting in bed with the powers and the forces and the authorities too. And so it just kind of, okay, instead of just, it became a little more diffused, but it was still kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so...
I wanted to say that there's a real problem sort of between, because I sort of go into those both worlds. I practice mediumship, and I also deal with what are called pagan religions, but I'm not sure if pagan religion is really as good a descriptor, but I've hunted ghosts, and I go to classes on channeling, manifesting. They talk about angels and spirit guides, and there's nothing really evil about it. It's just another form of spiritual practice or religious beliefs. And it's very, and sometimes we take the Bible too literally sometimes, and we tend to demonize the people who the Bible might be, or the author, or the particular author might be demonizing. But in another part of the Bible, we see discerning spirits as a spiritual gift. And what is that? That's probably speaking with spirits.
But I'm not sure that discerning spirits, I think, there's one place, and I can't remember the verse there, and it says, test every spirit to see whether they are of God. Okay. And it's kind of like, and I think that was Paul saying that. It says, not everything is, created equal or whatever in the spiritual world.
Right. But the one thing is important, it creates a lot of anger in these people. And a lot of these people do not like Christians. A lot of people do not like Christians specifically because of the exclusionary nature of the faith and the idea that these really what are mostly women, people who, or want to explore their past lives or talk to their spirit guides and get in contact with their spirit guides or their spirit animals or communicate with angels. These are not bad people, and they're not evil people, and they're just another religious faith. And I think we should treat them as another religious faith, as another spiritual path, just like we treat Buddhism or Buddhist or Muslims or Hindus, and their various variations. And I think it becomes problematic when we've sort of demonized these people and put them into the realm of these spiritual voodoo type of people, but then we find that the supernatural is taken out of the church. In other words, if we either accept the supernatural and then we accept other people's experiences of the supernatural, But if we sort of classify, oh no, all these, and it almost seems to me like they're trying to move us away from the supernatural.
It depends. If you know, the Pentecostals are very, very keen on the whole general idea of supernatural manifestations. Okay, and you know, the kind of the more mainline churches are kind of a little bit more standoffish on some of that stuff. But I still think, you know, I think the big problem, okay, you know, as you see, is the power thing. When you have religious groups having a lot of political power, that's when you saw things like witch burnings and so forth, okay? And well, Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world, okay? And so I think the idea that we should be exercising, or Christians should be exercising a lot of power in this world, I've had some bad experiences in churches, and it's like, God help us all if people like this ever get into kind of position of political power.
Yeah, but if we don't do something to counteract that, and that means being involved, that's my opinion, that you don't, by abandoning, by just handing the Bible over to these people and saying, and then saying, we're not going to do anything like that, I think is kind of just handing them a nuclear bomb to use against us, that we have to see the Bible as incredibly political, and that we have to be involved in engaging that process, because if not, we're just handing the weapon over to the enemy. But our time is up. So this has been Bible Study for Progressives, and I want to thank you, Professor Westfall, for being here again, and our engineer, Renee, and Undercity Comics here in Whittier, where we produce this podcast. They've been great. And you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, and YouTube, and like us on Facebook, join us on Meetup, and visit my blog at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Until then, this is Rich Procida. Thank you for listening.